Okay, so I will talk about holographic quantum error correcting codes. And this is a collaboration with Benny Yoshida, who's here in the audience. Dan Harlow, who actually was together with Ahmed Amari and Kai Dong, the one who realized this connection between holography and quantum error correction, and John Preskill. And so what we found is some toy models, which are based on tensor networks and mirror-type structure that sort of realize this type of correspondence. So the work that we started upon is, as I said, the work by Omeiri, Dong, and Harlow, in which they realized that in order to describe this mapping between the bulk and the boundary in ADS-CFT, one needs to have a mapping that is representing a quantum error correcting code. And the name that this has is the ADS locality, or the render locality reconstruction. So in ADS-CFT, one has a bulk space and a boundary space. They're in principle different physical systems. And one can represent the physics going on in one of them, or in the other, and there's a duality between the two. In particular, there should be a duality between operators. So if I have an operator acting on the bulk in some point, I should be able to represent it on the boundary. And in particular, when the limit of the point is actually very close to the boundary, the operator acting in the bulk very close to the boundary should correspond to a local operator there in the boundary. But one can go further. How can I express, let's say, this operator is acting here? So I can express it without accessing this part of my boundary Hilbert space when I take this dictionary. In particular, so if I want to represent an operator acting at this point x, I can take any minimal surface, and I should be able to represent it in this case in this yellow region, so yellow green region, because this point is inside that minimal surface, or in this blue green region. So I have two ways of representing it. Okay, so this is already telling us that this mapping doesn't seem to be unique in the sense that I have different ways of representing the same operator. But it can be even more troubling. So let's say I have this operator acting here in the center. Now I split the boundary into three roughly similar equal parts. And okay, so these in 2+1 dimensions, these are minimum surfaces. Actually, I don't have time anywhere in our work, so this can be thought of as a space-like flux. So this operator, I should be able to represent it in this region AC. I should be able to represent it in the region AB or in the region BC. In any of these three pairs, I should have a representation of that operator. So what do I mean by that? Let's say that I start in the vacuum of my theory. So this is a state that lives in the bulk. Now this state should have a representative in the boundary, so the ground state of this CFT. Now I act with some operator X on this vacuum. In the dictionary, I should get a new state sigma. Now these two are in principle different, so these two should also be different. They should be related by some operator in the boundary, which is this X twiddle. But where does X twiddle live? And what is this operator? So in principle, since I cannot tell whether this X acted or not in any one region, so I will have that the reduced density matrix of both rho and sigma should be the same here in A. If I look only at subsystem B, they should be the same. And if I look only at subsystem C, they should also be the same, because this guy is outside of the causality cone. However, if I look at any pair of these regions, they should be different. So if I reduce to this joint system, rho BC should be different than sigma BC, and similarly for any other pair of regions. So how do we resolve this? Well, actually, we've already resolved this in the context of quantum error correcting codes. This is precisely what a quantum error correcting code is doing. So what we can think of is, okay, let's think of the simplest code that does this. It's a Q-trade code where I can think I have, let's say my bulk space is just one Q-trade living here at the center, and my boundary Hilbert space is three Q-trades, one living in each one of these regions.
Why can there not be a partial correspondence? You're saying you're completely excluding that region A by itself tells information about X, right? I mean, why can't it, you're saying, you know, there is a correspondence between X and, you know, whatever you find in row AC. But why is it completely excluded? It can be some partial information.
Because whatever I do in this region should commute with the operators that that I have here. And so.
Yeah, but I mean, okay, maybe I should hold up the whole thing. It's a small question that I don't understand.
Because if I have an observable effect, that then I have the potential of anti-commuting with an operator that is acting on which comes from an operator acting there. And that means that I should be anti-commuting with operators that live on BC, and that's a different region. Yeah. Okay, so we have a simple error correcting code which maps a Q-trade into three Q-trades. This is the explicit mapping. And it has this property. It has the property. So if I want to think of the encoding map, this is the map that goes from this three-dimensional Hilbert space to this 27-dimensional Hilbert space. It's composed of, it acts in this way. So this operator maps the state J to this J twiddle, which is in the higher dimensional Hilbert space. And it's an isometry. And in general, for standard quantum error correcting codes, we have isometries. They're more general settings, but I won't get into that. And in particular here, what we have is that if I look at only a one-particle subsystem, independent of what encoded state I put, I have that the reduced density matrix is always the same. It's always the maximally mixed state on any one of these subsystems. So in this case, I trace out AB. I get that the reduced state on C is always the maximally mixed state, I over T. OK, so what is the error correcting context, and what is being tried to achieve? Well, one has an encoding map that goes from the logical Hilbert space to the physical Hilbert space and uses only one a subspace thereof. One has a noise process that we try to protect against, which goes from physical Hilbert space to the physical Hilbert space. And we have a decoder that takes you back from the physical Hilbert space to the logical one. And the hope is that for a certain family of noise, not for everything, of course, but for a certain class of operators that we call noise, we want this identity to hold. We want to be able to recover the original state. And OK, what kind of noise is this error correcting code protecting against? In this case, it's protecting it against one of the simplest errors, which is just erasure of one of the systems. So let's suppose that the noise I'm dealing with, this is, I'll call it noise C, is actually removing qubit C, so tracing out the third system in my code. Then how do I recover the original state from whatever I have in qubits A and B? Well, in this case, I can write the decoder depending on the noise that I have. I can say, okay, if I know that I lost C, then what I can do is I can apply some unitary to whatever I have left. So this is some density matrix on AB, and then trace out A. So here my unitary is, so you can see that actually the original, so the basis state that I get here is always the difference of the, say, the second value minus the first. So here I have 0, 0, 0. Here I have 1. So the second value minus the first. So this is what I will do with my unitary. And then once I get this difference, I can just remove the first component. And this is this will, this composition of encoding and decoding, noise and decoding, will give me the identity. So it's an error correcting code. But maybe what's more interesting is to look at this in the basis of operators. So if I had an operator which was acting on my original state. I want to see what's, and I can recover from the erasure of one of the qubits, then that means that I can realize this same operator equivalently after encoding by looking only at qubits A and B. And this is, in this case, this is how I do it. So I need to apply the dual map of the decoding on the operator that I have, and this gives me the operator that I would need to apply at the level of the physical qubits to realize this logic. So I can do this both for the Z and so in this case these are Pauli X and Z operators. The Z operator only introduces a phase in this computational basis, and the X operator is introducing a cyclic shift. Okay, so this tells me that I can represent operators in a. So this is the physical realization of the logical operator by only supported on one part of my system. And this is exactly what I want. I have the analogous operator at the level. I have the analogous operator at the level of the boundary, which is only using one part of the system. So in this case, I can take this logical Z, and I can realize it by this ZA dagger ZB, or I could have similarly considered the erasure of qubit A, let's say, and then realize it in terms of ZB ZC or ZA ZC, whatever. Okay, so now let's try to construct a dictionary between ADS-CFT and quantum error correcting codes. So in ADS-CFT, I have a state mapping from the ADS, which is the bulk space, to states in the Hilbert space of my CFT. So these are the boundary states. In quantum error correcting codes, what we have is an encoding, which goes from a logical Hilbert space to a physical Hilbert space. This mapping is what we'll think of as our encoding. We had bulk operators that were acting on this bulk. There have to be logical operators. And we have boundary operators. These will be physical operators. But not all physical in this context, not all physical operators correspond to bulk operators. We have this ADS Rindler reconstruction. This allows, let's say, given a minimal surface, reconstruct any operator that is supported inside this minimal surface on its boundary. And this is something that at the level of quantum error correcting codes, we should think of as a cleaning lemma or as a systematic way of realizing, giving a physical realization of those logical operators in a certain subset of the physical qubits. This is, in quantum information, this is called the cleaning lemma.
In ADS-CFT, we think that the Hilbert space of the bulk is the same as the CFT Hilbert space. So, but in this setup, you are considering only a subset of.
That's correct. I think it is possible that this sameness could be recovered if you go to infinite dimensional Hilbert spaces. But I mean, for now, we wanted to look at the finite dimensional Hilbert spaces, and then this, then forcibly one has to be looking at a subset in order to have this multiple realizations of the operators. So,
you asked considering local operators in the bulk and local operators in the boundary, so there are more than local operators in the boundary than local operators in the bulk.
No, but the Hilbert spaces, as Mark says, have to be isomorphic. That's the basic statement of ADS-CFT.
Officially considering local operators in the bulk.
No, but
first lines, that's the limit.
The logical Hilbert space is smaller, strictly smaller in this case than the physical.
The physical Hilbert space that we will be looking at is a subspace of this product Hilbert space. So,
what did you say about the cleaning? I mean, why would you want to clean out? You say you clean out one region part of one region.
So let's say I want to have a representation of Z that lives in BC. This is like cleaning A,
and yes, okay.
for C or if I want to have a representation on AC, this is like cleaning B.
Okay, but that is called ADS Rindler reconstruction.
So ADS Rindler reconstruction is gives a systematic way of given an operator that lives. So I have a given a minimal surface, I have an operator that lives on one side of the minimal surface. The way I understand it, it gives a systematic way of representing this operator as a CFT operator on one side of the boundary. Okay, so this is all the essentially my take on the realization of Almeri, Dong, and Harlow. And from this we started, and we wanted to have actually an explicit realization of this in terms of tensor network construction. So our motivation was, so we didn't know of any codes that had this kind of structure, so we wanted to build possibly better codes, and also try to gain insight into ADS-CFT, introducing some of the tools that we had from quantum information. So I guess I already introduced my take on this bulk locality and the connection to quantum error correction. What I wanted to introduce now is tensor networks. We've already had several talks, so I think I'll go through this pretty quickly. And I'll try to say what we want from the bulk geometry in terms of the tensor networks. And I'll introduce the two main results that we have for our tensor networks, which are these greedy bulk reconstruction. This would be somehow analogous to this ADS Rindler reconstruction. And show that we have, in our network construction, saturation of the Ryu-Takai-Nagi entanglement entropy as opposed to an upper bound, which is given for any tensor network. Okay, so tensor networks. I know, you'll get bored. It's a Ketbra operator decoder. So I will use one line for every index. And I guess what's particular about our presentation is that we'll have these boxes, and we have different ways of thinking of these boxes, because we have an operator here. And this operator, if it's a unitary operator and I reshuffle the indices, it doesn't need to be a unitary operator anymore. But we'll look at the special states or special tensors that have this property in several directions. Okay, so network contractions are like whenever I connect a link, I'm assuming sum over the index that is contracted. This type of network contraction ansatz has given rise to MPS, MERA, and representation of interesting states in an economical way. And as I said, the kind of property that we are using from these tensors are how to think of them in different ways. For example, if I have a unitary, I can apply it to a standard maximally entangled state, a singlet state, and I can get a new maximally entangled state. And this is a bijection. So I can map any maximally entangled state to a unitary by having a reference maximally entangled state. And the way to do it is I can partially contract it with a maximally entangled state, and then this state gives me back a unitary up to a global constant that depends on the dimension. Okay, so what happens? I guess I told you that if I have a maximally entangled state, I can map to a unitary. But what happens if I have a state which is maximally entangled along all bipartitions? Well, then what I get is I have a tensor. Now I reshuffle the legs of that state, which was maximally entangled. I draw it as an operator, it's a tensor, and such that I have three, say, the same number of incoming indices as outgoing indices. And this operator will be a unitary operator. So it doesn't matter how I permuted which permutation I used to permute the legs, this operator will be a unitary. And so these states have been called used in the literature and are called absolutely maximally entangled states. And they exist for any number of legs. The price one has to pay is that one has to increase the bond dimension. So the, in particular, the if one wants a state with the two k legs, so this is the this notation is used for error correcting codes, and this is the number of physical qubits, number of logical qubits, and the distance of the code, or the lowest weight operator that has a non-trivial expectation value on code states. And this chi is essentially the bond dimension. So the price, so here k is equal to 3, and the price I need to pay to get to construct such tensors is to have chi growing as a square root of k. There might be other constructions. For example, for these six legs, I can do this with a qubit tensor, but these are not systematic to my knowledge. Okay, so actually this this encode, I think I mentioned that this three qubit code, so this is uses three physical qubits to encode one logical qubit, and has distance 2 in the sense that I need to erase 2 qubits in order to mess up the code, or I need to, the lowest weight non-trivial operator has weight 2, and it's acting on qubits. And actually, the encoding operator for this code has this property already. So maybe one thing I should mention is a standard tool for describing quantum error correcting codes in quantum information is the stabilizer formalism. It's based on describing which operators act on code states in a way that they remain invariant. And it uses these cyclic shift operators and the phase operator, Z. And in this case, I have two operators that keep these states invariant. If I shift everything by one, so this is the XXX operator, I get the same state. That's true for all these three states. And if I apply a phase, which is additive with respect to the first and the third qutrit, and I subtract two in terms of the second qutrit, this is also keeps these states invariant. So this is called the stabilizer group. So whatever operator I construct out of multiplications of these things will keep these states invariant. And so let's say that T is the encoder that I have, and I have some, these are generalized Pauli operators that belong to the stabilizer group. Now I encode my state, and if I apply my Pauli to the encoded state, I should get the same thing. Some operator that is, where P is some operator generated in this group. Okay, but these are just two operators, and I promised you that and T is the encoder, so T has one input leg and three output legs. But in order to describe a state, normally in this stabilizer formalism, I would need four operators. Where are the missing two? Well, I can take a logical operator, I can act it there, and its physical realization, and this should also be the inverse of its physical realization, and this should also be invariant. So what I do is to go from this stabilizer group to a larger group that uniquely specifies this tensor, is say, so I keep these operators, but add an identity to them. So this XXX, I keep it here, and I add an identity because I'm not doing anything at the logical level. And this ZZZ, I keep, and I add an identity. But I also add, so this is the inverse of the X operator and its realization here on VC. It could have been any realization. And the inverse of the Z operator and its realization on AB. And these will always also stabilize the tensor because it's like applying a logical operator and then it's inverse.
So there are many ways to get from the code to a single state, but you want it to have a certain property, and that's why you're doing it this way, right? I mean, you have to, you generate something equal 403 state. Now, What is the tree label? Because now we don't have a distance anymore.
Now we don't have a list.
So,
this is just a state. Yes.
Yeah, so what is the three
labels? The three labels.
What's the property of the state that you want to have?
What's the minimal weight operator that is non-trivial on the state? That has a non-trivial expectation on the state.
Okay. Yeah, that makes sense. Okay. And that this is the way you construct, you get three.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Okay. So, yeah, the point was that we can construct such states as stabilizer states. And okay, now we want to, we had this picture for that was going from one code and had only one site in the bulk, but one wants to have a fine-grained bulk where one can identify the different locations in the bulk. For this one should go back to the work of Ryuta Kainagi, where they identified that the entanglement entropy of a region in the boundary was actually equal to the length of the minimal surface in the bulk. And this identification that was made at the level of Mera, that the entanglement structure of Mera actually has this logarithmic dependence in two dimensions. And so we want to have a network that has sort of this kind of geometry if we want to represent the same scaling of entanglement. So this identification was done by Singel. So what we will do is we'll put our tensors, which are corresponds to these absolutely maximum entangled states, or we call them perfect tensors, in the place of the tensors of the Mera, and we'll construct a network from that. And yeah, we'll look at the entanglement properties of that network. And if we use this network as an isometry, as a code, we'll try to recover this bulk Ringler reconstruction. OK, so maybe next I'll show you how, like what kind of geometries we were trying to look at. So let's say this. Let's say if you have a Mera, you would have you have two types of tensors. You have tensors with four legs. These one can draw with a square and think of edges as going from one type of face to the other. And one has the isometries, and these are the triangles. These have two inputs and two outputs. But the point is that in Mera, one has a preferred direction because the isometries are only isometries when one takes a specific pair of legs as input and a specific leg as output. And the unitaries are only unitary when one takes a specific pair of legs as input and the complementary pair as output. Whereas with the tensors that we are trying to use, we have unitarity along any direction or the isometric property along any direction. So maybe let's see. There's only a discrete set of geometries that one can do. And so, for example, the most symmetric object that we can find is this thing composed of hexagons, but then having four hexagons adjacent at each vertex. And this already recovers this is a regular tiling of the hyperbolic geometry. But then our tensors will not have any bulk indices. So what we want is to able to assign some bulk degree of freedom to every site in space. So let's say if we have a six-leg tensor and we want to dedicate at least one bulk edge, one index to bulk degree of freedom, then what we come up with is this regular pentagon tiling, where now I can think of every face as a tensor with six legs. Five of these legs are being contracted, and one of them is going into the bulk. And this will be the bulk degree of freedom. Okay, so, and this is the first code that we came up with, but this is, one should think of this as a element of a family of codes, which is contracting these tensors, these perfect tensors. So now I have one, each one of these blue pentagons is a tensor. These red legs represent contracted indices, and I have some indices that are free and going into the bulk. And at some point, I will truncate this this network. This is not an infinite network, and I'll have some indices which would have normally been contracted, which are which will be at the boundary, and these will correspond to my CFT Hilbert space. So one necessary condition is that if I want to have this quantum error correction properties, that the bulk Hilbert space should be smaller than the boundary Hilbert space. Otherwise, I cannot do this encoding. And this will actually arise naturally in the need for reconstructability. But OK, so this is in the case that we have some bulk degrees of freedom. But normally, if I think of some vacuum state of a theory, this state should be uniquely specified. So if I have a CFT and I don't want to assign degrees of freedom in the bulk, what I can do is I can contract everything in the bulk, and then even using the same kind of tensors, I'm left with a geometry that has all indices contracted and just boundary degrees of freedom. So this we will call a holographic state, and the previous where you have bulk edges which are free, we'll call holographic code because you have a logical input state in order to provide a physical output state. And the point is that these two are related. So if I have two tensors that have bulk indices that are free, what I can do is I can input a maximally entangled state. And this is sort of equivalent to having two tensors which are connected at one edge. And similarly, if I have a holographic state and I want to make a change in the state, I can cut one of the contracted indices. And now I'll get two indices that become free, and I can take this as input of a new code. Yeah, and similarly there I can input a maximally entangled state, say for example in these two bulk inputs, and contract that edge. If I do this in a systematic way, I might be able to go from such a geometry to such a geometry. So there is a connection. Okay, so first of all, we wanted to see that it's possible to do this bulk reconstruction in a systematic way. And for that, what we need to see is that if we have a unitary operator and some operator P acting on one side of it, one can actually push this operator P through into some equal norm operator, U dagger PU. And this is what we'll do in a systematic way in order to get from bulk operators, boundary operators living in a specific part of the boundary. The only condition that we have is since these tensors were unitary in any direction that I look at, I need to take as many inputs as outputs. So in this case, the pentagons, each pentagon has six indices, one being the bulk and five of them being contracted. So suppose I want to map an operator that is living here onto the boundary. What I can do is take these three indices as input and these three as output, and I map identity, tensor, whatever operator I had here onto these three indices. Now I repeat this again. If I have an operator which is acting here, I multiply it by identity on the bulk index and the other some other contracted indices, and I can push this operator in this direction. And if I have a sufficiently negative curvature, I can do this systematically until I push things all the way onto the boundary. And this happens in this regular pentagon code. In particular, if I was dealing with if this tensor came from a stabilizer code, the property that I have is that if I map a Pauli operator in any one of these legs, and when I try to push it in some direction, I will get a new Pauli operator. In quantum information, this means that this operator is a Clifford operator when I look at it as a unitary. Okay, so maybe one example of how these operators would get pushed through in the case of Pauli operators. So if I have a Pauli X operator, I might end up pushing this into this tensor product of ZXZ. Now this X needs to disappear. I want to push this to this tensor. I want to push that guy to that tensor on top. So I'll get this CYY. Anyway, so the specific result will depend on which tensor I put in. Here, I'm assuming that it's some Clifford tensor, not. But in general, I will be able to push operators to those tensors.
So if it hadn't been hyperbolic, they would collide?
If it hadn't been hyperbolic, they would collide. And I might not find a way of getting rid of some operator. Okay, so that's like after repeating this pushing operation several times, I can end up at the boundary. Okay, so what do I need in order to be able to systematically do this pushing procedure? I need some ordering of the tensors in which order I'm going to clear them. So I need to assign an arrow to each edge such that I'm not going back and let's say, and filling with operators part of my tensor network that I had already cleaned up. And yeah, this is something that one can do for this Pentagon code. But in general, what one can try is to solve the inverse problem. Try to ask, given a piece of the boundary, what part of the bulk can I recover from that piece of the boundary? And this is something that we find somehow analogous to this causal wedge reconstruction, which is the Rindler reconstruction. In some cases, it's possible to do a reconstruction beyond this causal wedge when these pieces of boundaries are disconnected. And this is somewhat analogous to the entanglement wedge reconstruction that has been discussed. OK, so now, independent of what these tensors are, I can decide bulk operators I can systematically reconstruct. So in this case, let's say I have this tensor for which I have access to three of its legs. It has in total six. So for sure I can map this bulk operator onto the boundary. But once I have access to this bulk this tensor, I could have said, okay, then I can also map this bulk operator because I can take these two as input and this bulk as input and map it into these three. And similarly for this bulk operator. So I can recursively ask what bulk indices I can ask. So now I add these at the second level. I can go again, and now I can add this guy. But at this point, I get stuck. I can't add anything else because all other tensors have too many. So here I'm assuming that I don't have access to the sad qubits, and I do have access to these happy degrees of freedoms, and I get stuck. But what's interesting is that, contrary to this concatenated code error correction, if I have access to more things, even on the other side, I can reconstruct even further. So now, I don't only have access to this on the first level. I should also get access to this. So I can try this procedure again. Now, up to this point, I have two distinct regions that I'm reconstructing. But now I can reconstruct this guy at the center by mapping it into two opposite directions. So this will be included as the third guy. And what's further interesting, once I have access to the center, I can also continue growing towards the sides. Now I can reconstruct this guy by mapping to the center here and here. And I can reconstruct this guy. And in this case, I can have access to the full bulk Hilbert space. To the I can read off all the operators from my bulk. Okay, so one thing that we try to do in quantum error correction is to try to figure out how good these codes are. And this and the way one of the ways of benchmarking this is in terms of the distance of the code. The distance of this code is pretty bad, because if I erase, say, 3 qubits here, then I've already lost this guy forever. I can never recover it. But this is something that is totally consistent with the Rindler reconstruction, because I shouldn't be able to reconstruct this guy if I don't have access to, if I've lost the causal wedge of this guy. But the other question I can ask is, okay, maybe the qubit at the center is well protected. In the Pentagon code, this is not true. So the way that we benchmark is look at the randomly sample which qubits are lost and which qubits are kept according to some uniform distribution. So each qubit is kept with some is lost to some probability p, and we might look at what's the probability of recovering the qubit at the center. And we can look at a lattice where all of its components are hexagons, so it's similar to this holographic state, but one has 1 degree of freedom, which is kept at the center. In this case, the thresholds or the probability of recovering this guy is high up to a very high threshold, which is losing. So until keeping 52%. If I keep more than 52% of my qubits, then I have a very high probability of recovering this guy. And what these different curves correspond to are different depths of growing this lattice in the radial direction. So this a single pentagon would be n equals to 1. Having the nearest neighbor hexagons would be n equals to 2, and so on. Okay, so this says that if I have 1 degree of freedom that I want to recover, maybe the threshold is maybe close to 1/2. So we recover this 52% from the from this greedy algorithm, which was the one I presented in the previous slide. But in principle, it might be possible that one can recover even further if one allows the approximate correction or other properties of the code. Okay, so I guess that's enough in terms of bulk reconstruction. So now let's see that this tensor network construction actually saturates this Ryutaka-Inagi entanglement entropy in terms of the number of edges that are being cut, and not just have it as an upper bound. So how can we show that a certain network saturates the entanglement along some minimal cut? Well, one way of doing that is to interpret this tensor network as a unitary circuit where this line is separating part of the input and part of the output. So what I will be doing is looking at the circuit and trying to lay it out in a flat way. So fixing, in some sense, it's like the flows that Matthew was presenting. So I need to interpret and give each edge directionality. But the difference is to guarantee that this entanglement is there, I need to give an interpretation to every edge. I can't leave an edge which is unused in my flow. And for the assumption that these tensors are perfect tensors, we can actually prove that this Ryutaka-Inagi is actually saturated under certain additional assumptions, which are having a simply connected boundary region. So Ryutaka-Inagi is supposed to apply to minimal surfaces. Also, when the boundary is disconnected, well, we cannot prove this for a generic choice of tensors. That we have actually examples of perfect tensors where, say, this boundary is not saturated, or when the curvature is positive, then our proof doesn't hold. Or also, when we have input edges, then we also have examples where Rita Kainag is not exactly saturated. But in fact, in ADS-CFT, we don't want it to be an exact statement. We want it to be in it has some corrections, which are due to the bulk degrees of freedom. OK, so how does the proof of this statement go? Well, we want to build a circuit interpretation of the tensor network. So in this picture, what I want is I will have the tensors living on the vertices. And yeah, so these edges will be the contracted indices. And in order so I'll think of this as a graph. And in order for this graph to represent a circuit, I want each tensor to have the same number of incoming and outgoing edges. In order to not have closed time-like curves, I want to not have any cycles in my graph. And furthermore, the condition that this circuit interpretation saturates Ruta Kainagi is that all the edges in the circuit that cross a minimal surface should be pointing in the same direction. This is the flow condition that Matthew was telling us about. So we know that there is a max flow min cut theorem. But in this case, the fact that we want to use every possible edge is an additional constraint that I haven't seen in the literature. So we have to give a construction of an explicit construction of this flow. And we have this explicit construction for a 2D planar graph with the negative curvature. So how does this go? First, why did we draw this dual picture? Because we want to label the faces in this picture. And we label them according to where this minimal surface starts. This guy we label 0. Then the nearest neighbors of that guy we label by 1. The second nearest neighbors we label by 2, and so on. So this is essentially the distance from this point on the dual lattice. Right, so this is like a distance function on the dual lattice. I mean, this is an artifact of the proof, but I wouldn't know how to generalize this to higher dimensions. OK, so now we want to use this labeling in order to construct a directionality for the edges. And the property that this labeling has is that it's increasing along the faces that this minimal surface goes through. So you have 0, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, precisely because this was a minimal surface, a minimal distance curve in 2D. And now what we can do is, OK, I want the directionality for each edge to be such that the larger number is on the right and the smaller number is on the left. So this potential, this is like taking the curl of this potential. And yeah, this guarantees me that all the edges that cross this minimum surface cross it in the same direction. And it also guarantees that since all the faces are labeled by nearest neighboring values, it also guarantees that the number of edges coming in and coming out of each tensor has to be the same. So that the sum of incoming edges minus outgoing edges has to be equal to 0. Because I can think of this. So this is incoming if this is this number minus this guy is 1. And it's outgoing if this guy minus this guy is minus 1. So OK. So we have incoming is equal to number of outgoing. The property that we have no closed time-like curves is a bit harder. But one can convince oneself that in order to have a closed cycle in this directionality, one has to have a local maxima inside this labeling or a local minima. Local minima cannot exist because these guys are defined in terms of the distance from 0. And interior maxima can only exist if one has positive curvature in this dual lattice. So this is implied by the positive curvature condition that one will not have these closed curves. Okay, so after doing that, for each, not necessarily for each RT surface, but for each point, one has constructed a flow that has this this property. This flow is not saying anything about the state that lives on the boundary. It's just one interpretation that allows us to guarantee that the entanglement, say from this region to this other region, is not just upper bounded by this length, but also exactly that length. So we have what we are doing is like having a circuit layout of this tensor network where this RT surface is a curve that cuts exactly as that many indices. Okay, so in holographic states, I guess I showed you that any minimal cut will give you the entanglement, say, from this boundary. So let's say that here we have a holographic state where each vertex of this lattice is a tensor. But I actually have a bunch of minimal surfaces because I'm discretizing the graph. If I take this region to be A and this region to be AC, then this is a minimal cut. This is a minimal cut, and also this guy. So what can I say in terms of reconstruction? Well, if I try to apply the greedy algorithm starting from this guy, I would end up here. If I try to apply the greedy algorithm starting from this guy, I would end up here. And these contain all the minimum surfaces. But this statement is only true for holographic states. And I'm interested in situations where I have bulk degrees of freedom. OK, what happens when I add bulk degrees of freedom? So one way of adding was this cutting of a certain index. Well, then the greedy lines of reconstruction will recede. If I start from A, I will be able to reconstruct this blue line, which will only contain one of these 2 degrees of freedom that I'm creating here. If I start from the complement, I will be able to reconstruct this red line, which only contains one of the degrees of freedom that I'm creating from this cut. OK, so how does that relate to black holes? Well, there's only a certain amount of degrees of freedom that I can free inside a certain region. And that's actually given by the perimeter of the region. This is clear. So in this case, if I make these 3 cuts, I can still reconstruct. But I'm actually saturating the boundary of the region. So that is as much as I can reconstruct. So I actually need to know that I'm there in order to do this reconstruction. OK, so maybe now let me conclude. So I guess I've illustrated that these perfect tensors that have very special entanglement properties allow us to reconstruct geometries and to make a connection of tensor networks in the way that we expected this bulk reconstruction to happen. We constructed a family of error-correcting codes from tensor networks that respect this bulk locality, possibly have an erasure threshold. And and vacuum states that satisfy this Ryutaka-Yanagi. And there are really many open problems from this. In particular, if one wants to think of this as an error-correcting code, one needs to find actually good code parameters or good families of lattices for these codes. Find good decoding algorithms, which work not just against erasure, but against the more general forms of noise. And at the level of the physics, one would like to identify some kind of dynamics for which this this representation will work, and also be able to get some sub-ADS locality. So by this, what I mean is that each tensor has a constant amount of curvature associated to it in this regular tiling. And what we would want is to have degrees of freedom to have really many degrees of freedom associated to each unit of curvature, while still having a very small spatial resolution compared to that. And also trying to generalize the proof of this entropy to higher dimensions is also an open problem. That's it.
So you talked about codes and states. It just wasn't clear to me in the context of ADS-CFT analogy. Like, what is it really codes that you would want to be talking about only and not states? And if so, is there some preferred, like, relative dimension of the bulk edges and the boundary edges? Like, should they be isometric?
Okay, so what I would expect in the ADS-CFT analogy, you should have a ground state for your bulk theory, so a lowest energy state. And this uniquely specifies your state. So in that sense, I think one should be talking about a state, and this should be the ground state. But then in the ADS-CFT analogy, one talks about low energy states in your bulk. And these are the ones that should be mappable to the boundary. And in that sense, one should be speaking of code. So, and OK, and with respect to the dimensionality of your Hilbert space, in the case of this ADS-CFT correspondence, the Hilbert space is anyway infinite dimensional. So in that case, I don't know whether you can make sense of counting parameters and saying that one Hilbert space is larger than the other.
Can I follow that up with one thing? I mean, maybe another way to ask the question is, you mentioned that time doesn't exist anywhere in your discussion. But let's just for a minute entertain the idea that we start with the ground state of CFT and of the bulk, but then we somehow send in an excitation from the boundary. This is something that I always hear people talk about an ADS-CFT. So then we excite the bulk. So does that mean that we're somehow going to have to open up lines inside this network in the interior by virtue of having sent something in? See, it seems, I don't understand. It seems inflexible once you have a state with no open lines in the bulk. You're sort of stuck with that no matter what you do at the boundary. But we should be able to excite the bulk by something we do at the boundary. So just puzzled how that would come about.
I agree that somehow the entanglement structure that provided by this model is very rigid. So in any physical model, you expect the entanglement, for example, to change, say, if you send an excitation, to change continuously. Whereas here, the restriction that you have perfect tensors says, OK, your entanglement is either 1 or 0 or the number of bonds that you're. So you wouldn't be able to entertain a continuous time evolution while at every point in time having such a structure.
Couldn't just one open each one of those edges? Would it mean that you will not be able to access a single point? It distorts the stability of putting something on the boundary and just exciting a single link?
Honestly, I don't understand what it means to do something on the boundaries and have it go. So does that mean doing something on? Because they're different. Like, for me, they're different Hilbert spaces.
Let me add on a question to go. So I wonder if the following picture actually explains what you have. So if I understand correctly, those perfect tensors are actually something that looks like a determinant of n qubits with n degrees of with n levels, n links. Is it correct? Asymmetric state. No. When you have a determinant of n states of each subsystem has n levels, but nits, n nits of n levels. Is it correct? Like if you have a treat, you will have three treats of each one of them has three degrees of freedom. And then this state is completely anti-symmetric, meaning that if you choose any sub-determinant, any sub-determinant with a completely with complete correlations, like the EPR sort of correlations with the rest of it. So this is sort of a generalization from symbolically. To get the tensor, you just kind of contract it with, back in the
That's not how we get the tensor, but that might be a good way and maybe more
so
better physically motivated way
so
of getting.
Okay, so if this is correct, then it means that since you have something which looks like a generalization of an EPR, you can take a finite set of indices, apply a rotation or do a teleportation, you could exactly teleport it to the rest of the indices.
Mm-hmm.
So this kind of organization of those peps, I think, of construction. A subset of indices, you do some rotation, then it starts to propagate all over the EPR state without losing it. So that's kind of the picture
that's,
I have.
That's
you actually
picture.
Do something and it's kind of teleported in the direction that you choose by eliminating some of the other legs, so it doesn't propagate in the other So it can not go also in the other direction, as Ted was suggesting. You just start at the boundary and then you apply the unitary rotation and start going in. But then it's not clear if we're kind of focusing to our point.
Well, in this finite dimensional situation, it doesn't always happen. If you happen to have prepared a logical operator, which is not all, in this finite dimensional space, not all operators of the boundary are logical operators, then it could focus into some operator in the bulk. But in order to focus to one point, one has to prepare a very special logical operator.
I have another question, which is, it's true that maybe have the same entropy, like in the water kinematic case, if you have a minimal cut, but the state, the relation between energies and the nature of the state of the boundary is completely different. And the picture is that no longer there is the state of the boundary doesn't seem to correspond to anything which is similar to
a conformal field theory.
Sort of natural state to think of it, the structure of a similar behavior, different state, different energies, everything gets lost in a sense by this mapping. Just a very particular state, but not CFT state.
It's not a CFT state, I agree.
So I had a question about degeneracy. So the Hilbert space, your bulk Hilbert space is much smaller than your boundary Hilbert space.
Mm-hmm.
So I guess that means that, does that mean that if someone were to give you a precise description of the bulk, so every piece of information you would want about the bulk, and then they were to ask from that bulk information if you could reconstruct the boundary, that you would only be able to reconstruct the boundary up to some degeneracy that is proportional.
Well, if you take this isometry to be true, then you're actually specifying what subspace of the boundary you're using, and you're specifying an equal dimensional subspace. I think the physically relevant question is, would you be able to map to predict all the observables in the boundary?
I guess that's the thing that's a little confusing to me, because things that are not logical qubits in the bulk seem to be logical qubits in the boundary. Is that not true?
So in this dictionary, the bulk are the logical qubits, and the boundary are what I call physical qubits.
Right. But that means that you have a not one-to-one map. So if you try to reverse the map, you're taking one logical qubit, you could land on any number or combination of physical states that is dependent on the structure of your symbol.
No, because you use a subspace of the physical Hilbert space. This subspace is not locally defined, but you use a subspace that has exactly the same dimension.
But I mean, it's true. So a lot of stuff operators can put on the boundary
there's
outer
operators
space, which do not have a representation at all.
Everything's question is what about states that are outside this
In the boundary?
Yeah.
We don't have a way of making sense of them.
No, but
in a middle space, there's more operators.
I think there is something that can be said, maybe more.
Well, I was going to make a comment. I mean, I think that there's a point, which is that it may be that you know, just a certain subset of CFT states have a nice geometrical interpretation. And mm-hmm. I mean, I think that was maybe one of the ideas that subspace of states that should have these properties that you were talking about at the beginning. And so it may be that subspace of states of the CFT, you can think of it as like code subspace.
Right.
And so the questions about whether these things are isomorphic, I mean, you don't necessarily want that. There may well be a much bigger set of CFT states that mm-hmm. where you don't have a gravity dual and you don't expect this Utakunagi formula to be applicable.
But it might actually be even more than that, because I think that what they're calling the code subspace is not the space of CFT states that have good hologramic dual, but it's much smaller than that. It's the space of states of perturbative quantum fields on a fixed ADS background. So their
yes.
bulk is always ADS, and then they're allowing bulk field excitations, not classical excitations, not things that actually back react, but just sort of perturbative quantum field fluctuations on that. And that's an even smaller subspace.
Okay, I thought they had, I mean, you have the flexibility at least to change up your network.
You can change the network,
right,
but that's a different code.
Yeah.
In
like
the,
for,
in
a, if, for a given network that has this set of,
yeah, okay,
right, that would be sort of quantum field fluctuations
right.
in a fixed background.
Right.
Okay, so thank you very much.